Good afternoon. Calling State Affairs Committee to order. It is 4:23 p.m. Martha, would you please call the roll?
Representative Vance, Representative Shaw, Representative Hopkins.
Here.
Representative Story.
Here.
Representative Wolf.
Here.
Representative Fields.
Here.
Representative
Chris Duncan. Here. With five members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. We have a presentation at Vote at Home, a.k.a. Vote by Mail, today, as well as SB 100 and HB 132 on the agenda. Thank you, Martha and Taylor, for facilitating today's meeting. Starting with Vote by Mail, the presentation, I'm going to take a quick at ease. Going back on the record, there are two presenters today, Dennis Wheeler from the Municipality of Anchorage, as well as Amber McReynolds, Executive Director of the National Vote at Home Institute. We'll start with Mr. Wheeler. Mr. Wheeler, if you could please put yourself on record, and if you could summarize the Municipality of Anchorage's vote by mail initiative and rollout and the status of Anchorage's voting policy.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I work for a company called Resource Data. Resource Data was contracted to assist the Municipality of Anchorage in initiating and conducting its vote by mail project. Barbara Jones, the municipal clerk, wanted to be here, but unfortunately had another commitment that could not be changed, so she asked me to step in and speak on her behalf regarding the project. I know some of the members of the committee are from Anchorage, so they've had the experience of at least two elections, possibly three, when we had a special election last August with vote by mail. It, from my perspective, it's been very successful in meeting its objectives in terms of trying to create more voter engagement, simplifying the process for the administration of elections, and providing a way for voters to exercise a number of different ways to return their ballots versus the more traditional poll-based voting methods. I like to think of it as more of a universal return system than strictly vote by mail. And the reason for that is because we provide not only the ability to return a ballot by mail, but voters can also visit one of six different vote centers the city sets up, and also use the drop boxes that we've placed around the city and have opened during the election cycle. The basic concept, for those of you who may not be familiar with it, is that we receive the voter data from the state of Alaska. We use that voter data to match up with our GIS systems so we can pinpoint the voter location to make sure they get the right ballot. As you may know, we have a number of service areas and boundaries to deal with, not to mention the precincts. So we have somewhere well over 100 different ballot styles, closing in on 200 different ballot styles, so we have to make sure each voter gets the right one in the mail. So we put them through a GIS process to pinpoint what kind of ballot each voter will get. Then we send that data to the printer, who generates the ballot packages. We sent out well over 200,000 ballot packages in this last election cycle. In that package, each voter will get a return envelope that's specially coded to that voter. The voter will get a secrecy sleeve and a ballot, as well as voting instructions. Those voting instructions can be customized for different voters. For example, a number of voters who are registered online through the state PFD program or otherwise may not have demonstrated the ID requirement necessary to fully complete their registration. So we can see that in the voter data. We include a special insert for those voters so that they can include with their return not only the ballot, but also the required photocopy of the ID meeting the state requirements for that purpose. So the packages drop about 3 weeks before the election, so the voter gets those in plenty of time to look over the ballot and consider the issues and candidates and then submit it at their convenience, as long as they do so either with appropriate postmark by election day or drop it off at the vote centers or drop boxes before 8 o'clock or of course, any time before then. I should pause there for a second, Mr. Chairman, just to make sure that if there are any questions, people feel free to interrupt me and ask those as we go.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Wheeler. I first want to note Representative Shaw joined the committee at 4:25 p.m. Welcome, Representative Shaw. Any questions from the committee for Mr. Wheeler? Representative Story.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. We had had a similar presentation, and I'm trying to remember how long ago that was. And it was about security and making sure the ballots were ones that that particular person had submitted. Are you going to be talking about how that is done later, or can you share that now?
Through the chair, I'd be happy to do that now, and then I can backtrack to some other points. So, as I may have mentioned, each voter is assigned a ID, it's a barcode number, for this specific election. So every election, each ballot package for each voter will get a different ID. When those return envelopes come through our system, the system can recognize that ballot ID, and it can recognize the voter tied to that ID, and it can identify whether or not the same ID number has been used again, or if the voter has voted more than once. And when that happens, that package is sorted out on the sorter in a mechanical fashion, and the election officials can review that and try to determine what happened and whether there needs to be any particular follow-up. There have been a few instances where a voter will get a package in the mail. For whatever reason, the voter will vote that package, but they might also go to a vote center and vote there. Because we don't expose election data across the Internet, these isolated vote centers don't have real-time updated data. They have the voter data as it exists at the start of the election. So if a voter does vote their package, they get it home and then walks down to a vote center and votes, the system at the election center will catch both of those packages and identify that that voter voted twice. And if that happens, we then do a follow-up, and if needed, we refer that to the municipal attorney's office, and they can, or to the Anchorage Police Department for follow-up if they think there's a deliberate attempt to vote fraudulently. So that's one area of security we have in terms of the ballot package IDs. The other level of security we have is that the voter is expected to sign their return envelope. Those signatures are matched in our system against signatures from previous elections, both state and local elections. So we had a part of our project was to help the state build up their database of signatures provided by the voters from the poll books and from absentee applications and so on. So we had our election officials trained up by professional law enforcement officials from Washington State to provide this service. And they go through the training, and when the envelopes come through the system, the election officials apply that training to each signature and determine whether that signature is a match to the ones that are in the database. And when that happens for each envelope, there's actually two reviews. There's two different people that will review that same envelope, so it gets reviewed at least twice in the process.
Mr. Wheeler, Representative Wohl has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So let me understand, just so make sure I heard that, you verify every signature of every envelope that comes in by hand, by person?
Yes. And wow. It goes quicker than you might think. In the software, each election official will see four voters on the screen, and they'll go left to right, and they can quickly look at the signatures related to each voter. And we have eight stations that we operate at the peak time, and we have envelopes coming through. And, you know, we did 65,000-plus envelopes this election, and it went pretty quickly. Because they do it, we do the envelope review process every day that we receive envelopes. So it's not as if we wait to the bitter end and then do them all at once.
Representative Wall.
Thank you. So when I go and vote at the polling place and I sign a register when I vote, is that matched against anything, or that's just a perfunctory duty that we all have to do?
So in the poll I'll call it old-fashioned. In the current style of voting at a poll-based election, you sign the poll book. If there was some question about your identity, in theory that could be matched up, but that's not done as a matter of routine. What we did for our project is we actually took the last three municipal elections, and we scanned those poll book signatures and added those to the state database. And the state already had some signatures. It was building up a good database of, or a good library of signatures based on the paperwork it had received before through absentee applications and so forth.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And lastly, I can imagine it's not that big of a leap to at some point have some software that verifies signatures, just like it does facial recognition. It can do signature recognition, so you could just zing them through a machine with a fair amount of artificial intelligence, and you could probably save the labor of visually verifying every signature, right?
Yes, that's true. In fact, that software already exists. At the time the municipality acquired this system, it made the business decision not to spend the additional money on the software piece, because it was our understanding at that time that every system that had computer verification also had human verification over the top of it. And the reason for that is signature verification is quite a tricky operation in terms of telling the computer how many different points of reference you're willing to accept or not, and deciding whether you're going to reject or not reject a signature, or at least flag it for further review. And in learning about that, we just thought, you know, we could save the money, and it would be, if we're going to do human review anyway, it would be much faster and more efficient just to do it that way, and we can always come back to add the software layer over the top if we want to.
Thank you.
And Mr. Wheeler, I have one question about Anchorage's system. There was a fair bit of media after the rollout of vote by mail, vote at home in Anchorage and the cost associated with it. And I realize there's a lot of one-time upfront costs when you're setting up a new system or switching over systems. Can you comment on the sort of long-term operational cost of Anchorage's vote at home, vote by mail system versus its previous traditional polling place system?
Sure. I'm pulling these numbers from the reports that the municipal clerk's office generates with respect to costs. And so in their most latest report, in 2017, an assembly race, right, the mayor race was not involved. The turnout was 23%. Their costs were $670,000. For this last election, the turnout was 28.7%, and the cost was $646,000. So we're seeing a drop in costs, total cost, and a drop in vote, the per vote cost. Now, the first rollout with the mayor's race, the municipal clerk took the conservative approach in terms of overstaffing and oversupplying, because we didn't know how many people were going to walk into the vote centers and need all the different kinds of ballots that we have, or might need a second package mailed, and so on. So that election was much higher. It was $944,000 because it was the first one, and we just were cautious about not having what we needed on hand. So I think we're going to see our cost, the operational costs, go down as we get better at doing it, spend less staff time on it. The only, you know, the two big differences are we use fewer people, but of course we have to print envelopes and secrecy sleeves, so the printing costs certainly go up.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? And Mr. Wheeler, thank you for making the time, and feel free to stay on the line. We're going to transfer over to Amber McReynolds with the National Vote at Home Institute, and if there are questions about the material she's presenting on as it relates to Anchorage, we might pepper you with a question if you're available. But Ms. McReynolds, thank you for joining us. Please put yourself on record. We have your PowerPoint queued up. Feel free to verbally cue when you'd like us to advance slides, and proceed with your presentation.
Well, hi, good afternoon. And again, my name is Amber McReynolds. I'm the executive director of the National Vote at Home Institute, which is a nonpartisan nonprofit established about a year and a half ago to basically help states and localities with the implementation of vote-by-mail and vote-at-home type systems, and help with effective implementation and policy designs around those issues. Prior to this role, I was the director of elections for the city and county of Denver, Colorado. I ran elections and administered elections for over 13 years. I ran every type of election that there is in existence, including full polling places with early voting, with absentee and vote by mail, with all DREs, with paper ballots, and then I actually led the transition to go to a full ballot delivery system, which is basically vote at home, coupled that with vote centers, and we designed vote centers actually in Colorado and implemented them here. All of that policy change happened about 6 years ago, and from my position as Director of Elections, I led that effort to not only design the policy at the legislative level, but then implement the system in Denver and then also help across the state. So since that time, Colorado has become a state leading in various metrics, including the top voter registration rate in the country, because we, in addition to passing the and designing the policies around the voting process, we also improved our registration processes and implemented various modernizations and automatic address updates and more effective, proactive address updates through the National Change of Address database, as well as through motor vehicle offices. And then we kind of in this process and in this transition to full vote by mail with vote centers for an in-person voting experience, we were able to reduce costs by about 40% on average across the state. And the biggest cost savings has come with the capital expenditures that we have saved on voting machines and that technology that used to be rolled out to all the polling places that we had, to the tune of about an 80% to 90% reduction, depending on what the county had prior to implementation. So I come at this not only from kind of an organization that is focused on this reform, but also as a former election official up until last year in August. So very much understand all the mechanics and sort of the policies throughout. So the first slide, we can go to the next slide, and I just sort of set this up this way because I think it frames the reason that this policy it has been effective in the states that it's been rolled out in, and really that the voting process is about customer service, operational efficiency, and also innovation. And I always encourage legislatures and others to contemplate how to best serve voters most effectively and most efficiently, and kind of creating a fair process for everyone to access regardless of where they are in the process. So we can go to the next slide. So with our process in Colorado, this is essentially kind of the sequence of events that happened, and it's really great to see Alaska contemplating this change because it's sort of that first part of the process, which is the pro-voter policy design. And then the second step, obviously, if changes are made, is contemplating a voter-centric process for implementation, designing it in an effective way so that it's efficient for the voters. And then the third part of that is designing effective technology. And I heard the comment about the automatic signature verification software. That is something that we deployed in Denver, and that has worked very effectively over time. Many of the Colorado counties utilize that automatic signature verification software, and you can set it. So we have a very high match setting on it, and it would match between 35 and 40% of the signatures through that automatic process, and then the rest of the signatures would be reviewed by bipartisan teams of election judges.
And Ms. McReynolds, sorry to interrupt. Yep. Representative Hopkins has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. McReynolds, for coming and talking to us today. Does Colorado have email voting, electronic voting methods?
So we offer that. We do have those options. It's an electronic transmission process for military voters. And then that's also available to voters under special circumstances for emergencies or possibly accessible reasons.
Follow-up.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. But somebody has to apply for that and prove it. It's not available just to the general public. And then on top of that, what are the security measures Colorado takes to ensure voter security of those ballots that are sent between the voter and the Division of Elections?
For the electronic transmission or for the paper ballots?
For the electronic transmission.
Okay. So That it's sort of a secure FTP site process for military voters, and the system, there's a couple systems that are being tested this year, but the traditional system up to this point has included a sort of login with a key identifier that the, you know, military member, it would be unique to them, only they would know it. They would log in, they would make the selections on the computer, and then they would print, they could print the ballot and send it back. That was sort of the process that most followed. And when they, and then we would also encourage them to basically send it electronically to be sure that it got there in time. So as long as the electronic was in time by 7 o'clock on election day, and then the paper ballot, for instance, followed 8 days after, then the ballot would, you know, get processed and that reconciliation would happen. In some instances, they couldn't mail the paper ballot. So if you're on a submarine or if you're on, you know, if you're deployed in that way where you can't actually physically get somewhere to get a paper ballot mailed back, then those, in those circumstances, the electronic ballot would be tabulated. But again, that comes over as an encrypted PDF, basically. So it's not like it's votes kind of transferring across the internet. It's different in that way in that it's a PDF that's encrypted and then sent to a secure FTP type server that's not available on, you know, the in the public domain. And then those are downloaded, and then the ballots are printed out, and they're, you know, and they become a paper record that gets processed and counted.
Thank you very much.
Please proceed, Ms. McReynolds.
Okay, so we'll go on to the next slide. So there's a couple things, and this was brought up a little with the Anchorage presentation prior, but there's a couple of things where the states that have gone to basically expand the use of vote at home or expand the vote by mail process, they've seen a couple of things, and they've seen an improved voting experience, they've seen enhanced security, and I say that because, number one, it's, you know, 99% of the voters that are in mail ballot states, well, 95 to 100%, basically are voting on a hand-marked paper ballot, and then there's available options for, you know, either ballot marking devices or accessible devices in person, or for military voters that are, that is a very small percentage, but the majority are hand-marked paper. And then post-election, there's a risk-limiting audit that Colorado does, which this system actually makes it easier because it's all a central count environment. So there's not remote counting of ballots kind of all about. It's all happens in one place so that it's easier to track and record everything from a chain of custody perspective for the ROA. The other way that it enhances security is if you look at the four, there's now four vote-by-mail states. Hawaii just passed it last week. But the three that have been most prevalent in the last, 10 years or so is Washington, Oregon, and Colorado. Those three states essentially have the most accurate address list in the country. So of any states out there, they are the most accurate because they're all members of ERIC, which is the electronic sharing network among states. But they also do things like proactive list maintenance and address updates through the post office. And they also have automatic registration processes now, which basically makes that process of updating addresses more automatic, so that it's not reliant on the voter filling out a piece of paper or filling out another transaction. And then, because we're mailing out ballots, we need to know where voters are. So that ballot goes out, and it's not forwardable. So that's kind of the first verification in the process of the election, is we essentially are doing an address check by mailing the ballot out. If that ballot doesn't get there, it comes back undeliverable. The voter has to take action. They either need to come in person, or they need to update their address online and get a new ballot sent. Then the second verification kind of step in the process is when the ballot comes back, and we mentioned this, but signature verification occurs. If that signature doesn't match, as determined by two election judges that do the research, review multiple signatures, and go through that process, then we ask them for, we basically send a discrepancy letter and ask them for a copy of their ID and to complete an affidavit. They can return those items through electronic means, so it can be an email. There's also a text process that is now in operation in various counties in all three of these states, or there's a physical letter coming back, or you can resolve the discrepancy in person if you want. Then we're giving options and choice, so I'll talk about that in a little bit more in a minute, but by giving voters 3 weeks to have their ballot at home, to research issues, to do all that, we're seeing an increase in voters going farther down the ballot, making less mistakes, having more time to research issues and candidates that are on the ballot, and then they have more choice to vote when they want to vote, when it's convenient for them. They get more time and they get more options to drop off. So it empowers the voter. And then the piece I mentioned before, I mean, there's been significant cost reductions, whether it's capital expenditure purchases or operational efficiencies. But the bottom line is when you make the customer process, just like any business, if you streamline and make the customer process easier, you're going to reduce some of your costs with regards to customer service and operational efficiencies come about because you're not having to respond to either complaints or other issues that show up in the election process as we normally see it. It's also more efficient for campaigns, as we've seen, because they have to shift their way of thinking about this. But if you have voters voting over 3 weeks, you know, the closer it gets to election day, the more voters have turned in their ballots, the campaigns can focus on what's left. And so they have seen that their operations have had to decrease, you know, on some of the GOTV efforts and that kind of thing as the election day gets closer. And then we've seen increased engagement, mainly because it's easier for voters. And there isn't an effect on one party or another. It really just affects voters in a positive way across the board. So this has been very much a nonpartisan reform in all the states where it's been implemented and expanded. Next slide, please.
And Ms. McReynolds, as you proceed through the presentation, this is helpful and of interest to me. It may make sense to calibrate this at a particularly high level. I think there's a strong possibility that the committee will consider this subject over the interim, working with the Lieutenant Governor in the election policy work group. So maybe sort of think of this as a high-level primer to sort of get us oriented going into the interim, if that's helpful.
Yeah. That's great. Sure. So the next slide, I just wanted to share briefly our organization, as I mentioned, we're a nonpartisan nonprofit, and we're set up to support voters, and we're going to, you know, we have educational materials on our website that talks about the process generally, policymakers, so we have a lot of best practices on policy designs and things that exist elsewhere. We have a lot of research on our website. And then election officials to make sure that they do this correctly and don't avoid that they don't, you know, implement this incorrectly. Next slide, and actually if you want to skip forward to two slides, it should be like a blue and gray map up. This is the sort of state of affairs with regards to vote at home, and this is overlaid with a map on kind of engagement from 2018. So one thing to note is all three of the vote at home states are in the top seven states for engagement in the 2018 election, and all three of those states have less costs than a lot of states do around the country that don't have a high instance of this use. So there have been efficiencies across the board, as I mentioned, with capital equipment and that kind of thing. Next slide, please.
There's a question from Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the three out of the seven are voted home states. How come some states like Minnesota or Maine or other states, seem to be northern states for some reason, how come they do really well and they're not voted home? This is just methodologies that they use that are better than, say, Texas or Tennessee?
Yeah, so there's a couple reasons for that. First off, Minnesota usually ranks at the top, in the top couple states all the time, fairly consistently. There's a couple things there. First off, in 2018, they had actually two competitive Senate races, which was a rarity for most states last year. So two competitive Senate races, there was a lot of extra money spent in Minnesota from a voter, like, kind of outreach perspective. So I think that that kind of helped them a little bit. You know, they're about a percentage higher than where Colorado was. Colorado did not have any Senate races last year. So this is Colorado without a federal race high on the ticket. It had some congressional races, but did not have any Senate races. Minnesota also doesn't require their voters to affiliate with a party when they register. which traditionally in the states that don't require that kind of party affiliation, you can see that that sort of also kind of can help bump them a little bit. They also have registration, so they have, you know, same-day registration and other reforms that have impacted their engagement. Similar with Wisconsin. Wisconsin has same-day registration. And then Maine. So all three of them, I will say, have vote at home. They just don't have full vote at home. So they offer it as an option. So they might, you know, you could sign up for it permanently or perpetually or every election. So they do offer it as an option, and it is used widely.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Okay. So the next slide I wanted to share is really about kind of the down ballot races. So if you think about this, if you have more time to research issues and you're not rushed through the polling place, or you're not kind of unsure of what you're looking at on your ballot if you haven't seen it before or you didn't research ahead of time, we did a study out of Utah in 2016 and found between a 5 and 6% increase in down ballot voting. Well, that matters because, you know, if people can research issues and think about it more at home and put more thought into their choices, they can go farther down the ballot more effectively. And that's similar to what we saw in another study that came out in the 2018 election. An Emory professor found that the vote-by-mail and kind of vote-at-home electors cause an increase in turnout in municipal elections and a decrease in ballot roll-off on statewide ballot measures in presidential election years. They also found that voters that are getting their ballot at home are more informed because they can go and spend time researching issues over a longer period of time. So both of those two studies we actually have linked on our website, which I'll give you the links to this towards the end, but we have all this research available in a reference library for your consumption as well. Next slide, please.
A question through the chair.
Representative Story, a question.
So do you have statistics about how many people do not continue to go down the ballot? Is it? I guess I want to know, is it significant? Do they just vote maybe on a race they were interested in and not go into an issue?
Yeah, so we see that in – so basically what that study found was the vote-by-mail voters were going farther down the ballot to the tune of about 6 percentage points more turnout in those down-ballot races, whether it was, you know, local or even, you know, issues. And that's also what we've seen in Colorado, just with issues farther down the ballot. Colorado has very large ballots, and so we used to see a lot more undervoting prior to the implementation of our system, because people would just, they had people waiting in line behind them or they were in the polling place and they were just trying to get through the ballot very quickly. And just as an example, in 2018, the ballot in Denver was 3 cards, 6 full sides. And if you read every word on the ballot, it would take you about an hour to complete. And so if you can imagine, people, if they have to do that in person, it takes a really long time to vote, which means you have to have a lot more voting machines out there in polling places. You have to account for that longer voting time period. And when you look at what people skip, they often skip things because they're in a rush or they don't have the information available to them in the booth to make a decision.
And unfortunately, Ms. McReynolds, we don't quite have that problem in Alaska, but I think when encountering what the reality is in other states, it's pretty shocking and helpful to know this effect. Please proceed. Yeah. We're on the slide that current vote-at-home status by state.
Yeah, so this slide, I just really wanted to give kind of a national landscape of, you know, we've basically separated the vote-at-home or vote-by-mail status into 5 categories. So we call, like, a step 5 is kind of where Colorado, Oregon, and Washington are. You can see on here there's sort of a striped for California and Utah. That means that they're just transitioning from basically a permanent no excuse, which is step 4, to a full vote at home. And so California passed legislation a few years ago, and they're in the process of implementing that. Right now, I think they're up to about 11 counties that will be on that system by 2020. Utah is 99% vote by mail right now, so all those counties, with the exception of one, have opted in to send ballots out automatically before each election. And then the lighter blue is step four, and that just means that it's they have no excuse, which is similar to what Alaska has right now. You guys are in a step three state, and so that just means you have no excuse, but you file it each election cycle or periodically. The blue really just means that those states have opted for no excuse, but they let voters say they want to get all their ballots in the future by mail so that they don't have to fill out a request every time, and so that election administrators don't have to process those requests each year or each election cycle. And then down from there, step three is just no excuse. And then step two, like Texas, Louisiana, Tennessee, they're all excuse required with age waiver. So in those states, if you're over 65, you can request a vote by mail ballot. If you're under 65, you have to have a doctor's note or a legitimate excuse as to why you will be out of the jurisdiction on election day. And then step one means that, like, Missouri and Arkansas, West Virginia, Pennsylvania right now, they basically record, for anybody, you have to have an excuse. So if you're, if you have to have a doctor's note, or you have to prove that you can't, that it's physically difficult for you to get to the location, you have to prove every single time that you need a ballot mailed to you at home. So it's very administratively burdensome, and it's pretty strict on the voters to remember to do that every single election, because it doesn't hold perpetually. You have to fill it out and prove that every single time.
Ms. McReynolds,
sure.
First, I didn't realize that there were states where you have to, it really kind of blows my mind that it's like you're reporting to a teacher at school why you need permission to get an absentee ballot. I'm not sure I actually fully appreciated that that was the case in other states. I guess that's more of a comment, but my question is, as you know, we have House Bill 115, permanent absentee ballots. When states adopt no excuse permanent mail absentee ballot options, is it the case that basically sort of the market of, I don't know, convenience and demand, that the amount of people who choose that option increases with time once that option is made available to them?
Yeah, it depends. So, like, you know, Montana and Arizona are good examples. They've been step four for a few years. Both of those states are over 74% of vote-by-mail usage right now. Like, if I were the state legislatures in both of those states, I would be kind of thinking that they should transition, because that's exactly where Colorado was prior. And the main reason is that both of those two states, it's basically the most expensive process that they're utilizing right now, because they're sending out most of their ballots by mail. Most of the voters are using that, but they're still opening early voting. They're still opening polling places, and they still have all of that same equipment and allocation. So it's very expensive what they're doing now, and that's what we had in Colorado. But the good thing about it is, in all three of those instances, you know, you basically let voters choose, right? If you have that option there and you see it grow over time and voters have the choice to make that selection over time, then, you know, you can kind of watch it and see how it grows. The other great thing about the permanent option is, if you're an election official and you're going into 2020 and you know that 50 or 60 or 70% of your voters have requested to vote by mail, that helps you allocate your resources for in-person voting options much more effectively than if you don't have excuse and you don't know yet until, you know, closer to the election how many people are going to utilize that. That makes it hard to plan, and it makes it hard to allocate the resources if you don't know that in advance. So the step four status, honestly, is the most efficient kind of place to be when it comes to vote by mail, absent going to, like, a full model, mainly because it's more administratively efficient. It allows you to plan. That's where Wisconsin, Nevada, Kansas, New Jersey, they've all been in that status for a few years now.
A question from Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. Yeah, I want to ask a question that the chairman highlighted in his question. He described, we call it absentee voting here in Alaska, which I'm sure is called many other places, but now that we're just starting to have permanent absentee, have you run into states where words matter, and if you call it vote by mail or vote at home, there's a substantially different understanding of what the process is as opposed to calling it absentee, where traditionally people have thought they cannot, there wouldn't have to, they couldn't be at home in order to vote that way? Have you seen that language switched when you start down a more vote by mail process?
Yeah, and the reason that, so I would love to figure out a way to ban the word absentee from any of this, mainly because the word absentee doesn't mean anything to most voters. When you actually ask voters, they don't know what that means. It implies that they're absent from the process, which they're not. They're just using a different voting method. And so we have found that people understand that they want to vote, and the method is either mailing it back, or they're voting at home and dropping it off, or they're voting at home and mailing it back. So part of the reason that we adopted this sort of language is to try to make it easier for voters to understand what we're talking about, because when you use the word absentee, it really doesn't mean anything to the actual customer on the back end of what the process is, because it's sort of a term that's an election geek kind of term where people don't necessarily normalize with that. Description.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
We're on the slide, elements of an effective vote at home model.
Yeah. So I wanted to share this, and this is something that we have on our website. We have information around this, but, you know, I always like to say that, first off, there's not a one-size-fits-all perfect solution for every state. There is, you know, considerations that make states vary in terms of what their needs are. Not every state is the same size. LA County is by itself bigger than 42 states, so their needs and requirements are going to be very different than Colorado's or another state that's out there. So what we've tried to do here is as states think about improving their current absentee process, their vote by mail process, or, you know, the potential move to a vote at home system, these are really the important elements of that. So ballot delivery and that process and that relationship with the post office matters tremendously. I also like to point out, as it relates to the post office, that they're the only entity in the United States of America that serves every election office and every election official and pretty much every citizen in one way or another. There's no other vendor, there's no other entity that provides service in that way. The second element that's on here is this proactive address update. So I mentioned national change of address. So that's when you are at the post office and you fill out a change of address. We, for instance, in Colorado and some of the other vote-by-mail states do this, we consume that data on a monthly basis and then every other week when we get close to the election. So we know proactively who's moved, and we can move them. So we either move them to the new county that they're in, or we inactivate their record if they've moved out of state. Same with automatic registration. So automating that process matters for this particular reform. Effective cure process. So if a signature doesn't match, you want to have an appropriate process in place that allows voters to cure that, that's transparent and provides accountability throughout. The next thing, in-person voting experience. So we are not at all trying to say that there shouldn't be in-person options. We think that that's an effective, there should be in-person options available should somebody choose to do that. And that's what, you know, Colorado's done, that's what California's done, Utah, and now Oregon and Washington have added that in as well.
And sorry to interrupt, there's a question from Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you in your trailing comment, you said Oregon now has it, in-person voting?
Well, they offer it, yeah. So they offer it at limited locations, at, you know, similar to what Colorado designed with vote centers. They offer it at, like, their county clerk facilities, and then in some of the larger counties, they offer more vote centers. Same with Washington. You can vote in person in all these states if you want to. And then California and Colorado have more robust formulas for vote centers. So for us, we chose to have more options available than say, what Oregon and Washington have done.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it that if someone lives in one of those states, they get a ballot by mail? Does everyone automatically get one by mail in these states that are VAH? or VBM, I don't know what you call it, but you've used both vote by mail and vote at home expressions during this presentation.
Yeah.
So in a state like that, does everyone automatically get the ballot in the mail? And then if people lost it or they moved or they can't, whatever, they can just go in person, show an ID and vote?
That's correct. Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Okay. So ballot drop-off options, just offering voters either the option to mail it back or to drop off. And we have 24-hour drop boxes in Colorado. They also have those in all the states we talked about. There's also drive-up drop-off. Some states have allocated that. You know, drop-off options are pretty easy to put out at city halls or existing locations. And then the next kind of column, we already talked about military voters. And then we also audits and risk domain audits. Audits pre-election and post-election are important. Some states have gone to prepaid postage. So Washington went to prepaid postage. That's not something that Oregon has done yet, but they're contemplating it. Colorado is also contemplating prepaid postage. And then California has also implemented prepaid postage. And then there's a lot of jurisdictions across the country that have done that. Ballot tracking and ballot trace. So back in 2009, Denver created what's called ballot trace, and that is an automatic ballot tracking system. So it's just like if you track your package through FedEx, we do that for ballots. And that's important because then the voter gets full transparency where their ballot is at every step in the process. So the moment the ballot's been printed, when it goes out to the mail stream, and when it's out for delivery to them, and then all the way back again, and they get a confirmation that their ballot has been accepted and received for counting. So the voter has full transparency into that, and the election officials can also see, you know, where the ballots are in the postal process. And if a voter has an issue or there's, you know, they have the accountability and the trackability to make sure that the ballots get to where they're supposed to be. Civic design, so envelope design, instruction design, making sure it's clear and concise for voters, is very important. And then this next one is one that a lot of folks don't factor in when they're contemplating changes, but making sure there's appropriate penalties to protect voters in the law. And so, for instance, you might have seen the stories about North Carolina. They had to go to a new election because they had some election fraud that was perpetrated by campaign operatives. And part of the problem there is that they didn't have appropriate penalties in the law to prevent that nefarious activity from happening. They also didn't have a system like ballot trace, which would have told voters that there was an issue with their ballots in advance. And then considering processing and counting deadlines. So a lot of states will not allow counties or jurisdictions to count ballots or start tallying, not tallying, but counting and scanning until election day. That's problematic when it comes to vote by mail because it doesn't allow enough time for election officials to get that process done. So sometimes you want to contemplate the post-election or post-election certification and what that looks like post-election as you contemplate these systems. So next slide, we can skip this one. We have this on our website. The final slide I have here for you is really the resources available that we have on our website. So we have a policy and a research guide, and so what we've done there is basically collated all of the research, best practices, whether it's for training, signature verification. We've got sort of what states do. There's a compilation of where states are with their laws around this topic. We've got a research library that has, everything in it with regards to this topic. We also have a latest news feed where we post up all the stories about this topic across the country. And then our Twitter and Facebook are on there, and we try to regularly post up stories about this topic across the country. If there's interest there and you want to follow some of these things, these are all great resources that are available to you as a legislative body and just for your own research purposes. And then finally, the final slide just has my contact info. If anyone has further questions or wants to follow us or anything like that, feel free to utilize those.
Thank you,
I'm happy to take more questions.
I have one question, which is the 80 to 90% cost savings that can be associated with vote at home To clarify, is that sort of ongoing operational cost of administering a vote-at-home election system versus a traditional polling place election system? Or could you unpack that statistic a little bit?
Sure. So that is actually specific to the capital equipment expenditure. So that means like voting system purchasing. So when Denver, for instance, and I kind of say between, you know, 80 to 90, it might be 75 depending on the county, but that's essentially the savings we saw as a state. So when we passed this policy and then we purchased a new voting system 2 years after implementing this policy. And what happened was, if we had not gone to the system, we would have spent about, so Denver, as an example, would have spent about $15 million, maybe $17 million on a new voting system. Instead, we spent $1.5 million. And as a state, the state of Colorado spent between $17 and $20 million for all 64 counties. If we had not gone to this system, we would have been in the neighborhood of $150 to $200 million outfitting all the polling places with equipment necessary to process voters on election day and count ballots internally. So that is the biggest cost savings was there. The second biggest was in poll workers. So there was about a 60 to 70% reduction in the number of poll workers required to staff the election. That was a big one. And then equipment delivery, reduction in call volume, all of those pieces came into operational costs that were direct costs for each election cycle. And that is where, like, the Pew did a study of this post-implementation in Colorado in 2014 and found about a 40% reduction in operational costs for most of the counties across the state. And we have a link to that report in our reference library online as well.
Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Wohl?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The machines you're just talking about saving money by not purchasing. Obviously, you need machines to count the paper ballots. Did you have a paper machine, or were you electronic voting in Colorado?
Some counties were electronic with a paper option. Denver was all, we basically offered voters the choice. So you could either do paper or you could do the one or so machine that we had out there. So it just sort of depends which county that you were in. And by the point of us transitioning, we also were about 70 to 75% of voters asking for their vote by mail ballot. So again, with kind of running all the polling places, running all the early voting, and then also running 75% vote by mail, we were essentially getting calls from the remainder 25% that weren't voting by mail saying, why didn't you send me a ballot? You sent everyone I know a ballot. So we also took a lot of calls and confusion from those voters that weren't automatically getting it, which was part of the reason that we wanted to go to this type of system as well, to make it easy and understandable for all voters.
Okay, thank you. So,
Paul, Representative Wohl.
Yeah, so in Alaska, for example, we're all paper all the time. And so everyone fills out a ballot by hand. It goes through a machine that counts it, spits out a tape. So this would be the same with vote by mail, except you'd need fewer machines, and you could count them as they come in, right? So you wouldn't have to do a mass counting of so many ballots on election night. You'd need less machines, basically, right? And then, of course, there'd be some polling places still.
Yeah, you would need less equipment, probably. So if you're doing precinct scanners, it sounds like with the paper ballots, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have to do that. Like Colorado, we centrally count and tally everything, so it goes to a central facility so that we have to use less equipment to basically tally ballots. So you would potentially reduce some of that equipment need that you have right now at polling places. Probably wouldn't be as much of a savings for you as what some of the counties saw in Colorado, since they had a lot of electronic machines.
Yep, thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Mr. McReynolds, really appreciate you making the time. Likewise, Mr. Wheeler, and I think there will be more to come on this subject, so to be continued, but thank you both. That takes us to the next two items on today's agenda. First hearing of SB 100, as well as House Bill 132, SB 100. It's my intent to hear and move the bill. Ms. Morledge from the sponsor's office is available. Ms. Morledge, please welcome to the committee on the penultimate day of session. Please put yourself on record and feel free to present succinct comments on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Michicki. This is a very short bill. It's just one small section. And what it does is it renames the Alaska Vocational Technical Center dormitory to the Willard E. Dunham Residence Hall. I'll just give you a quick idea of the contributions that Mr. Dunham made to not only Seward, but AvTech and several other, the Sea Life Center and some other places there in Seward. He was not only the founding director of AvTech, but he was the acting director of AvTech for 50 years. He worked on the docks in Seward until the 1964 earthquake. He then moved on to the Department of Labor and the City of Seward, and he built up quite an impressive resume of community service and job projects, some of which include he was instrumental in finding a site for the AvTech school. He worked with the governor, Keith Miller, to get AvTech off the ground. He headed up the Spring Creek Correctional Center project and assisted in the building of the Seward Library and Museum. He was a charter member of the Rotary in Seward. He spent 6 years on the Seward City Council, 2 years as mayor, and he was president of the Seward General Hospital Board and the Fish and Game Advisory Groups. He also worked with the Longshore Union Boards. He served as Chamber of Commerce president twice, and he sat on nearly every city task force, commission, and local committee over a 60-year period.
Ms. Morledge, I am convinced.
Okay.
Although, clarifying question, you say 50 is in 50.
That's correct.
All right. Questions or comments from the committee? Representative Story.
Yes. Truly impressive, all that he has done for Alaska and for learning. I'm wondering, we didn't see any letters of support for this. What has been the community's response for the naming?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Story. You should have had in your packet 3 letters of support, one from Rotary, one from a colleague of his on the AvTech Statewide Advisory Board.
Representative Fields?
If I might, Representative Story, through the chair, I've heard strong support from the director of AvTech, and I think the binder fairy just failed to drop off some letters, but I'm looking at some from the AvTech Advisory Board members that strongly support naming the hall after him.
Thank you.
Further questions? A motion?
Yes. Thank you to the sponsor. This is a great bill. I move that SB 131-LS0743/A move from this committee with attached 0 fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Seeing and hearing no objection, Senate Bill 100 moves from committee. Thank you very much, Ms. Morledge, for joining us in carrying this legislation. That takes us to our final item of business on today's agenda. I think we have time for it, House Bill 132 from Representative Wohl.
I don't want to rush it.
It's the third hearing in the committee. I believe we have an amendment as noted previously.
I move amendment number 1.
I will object for purposes of discussion. Representative Fields, could you provide a short description of amendment number 1?
Sure. This amendment changes a percentage to ensure that the PFD provided under Representative Wohl's new structure would be in the neighborhood of $1,400, which I think is eminently reasonable and defensible, pretty in line, actually large by historic standards. I'm happy to defer really detailed questions in terms of all the moving parts of this bill to Representative Wohl, but I think this is a fair PFD that most Alaskans would support.
Are there any questions on amendment number 1? Representative Wohl.
Thank you. I don't have a question, but I do have a comment.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I thank the member for putting forward this amendment, because as I stated when this bill first got introduced, we introduced some values. In the original bill, it said 33% of oil revenue would go towards the PFD with an $1,800 cap. And I said, if we wanted to manipulate any of those numbers, I was open to suggestions. And Representative Fields suggested that, and 40%. And based on 2018 numbers, a 33% would be 1,142, and a 40% would be $1,384 on the PFD, and 2019 would be 1,435 based on revenues that we have. So it brings it up, and again, depending on price and production, that number can vary over time. So I do not object to the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Wohl. No other questions or comments, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection to passage of Amendment Number 1? Seeing and hearing no objection to Amendment Number 1, it passes. For the record, that is Work Order U.1. That takes us to the bill as a whole as amended.
I have a motion.
And just a hot second before the motion, is there any comment in case anybody is feeling voluble? Representative Wohl.
If anyone else wants to go first, they're certainly welcome.
We've got lots of time. Representative Wohl, please go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for hearing this bill and allowing the committee to hear it more than once. And the closer we get to the end of session, the more I realize we do need a PFD formula. And I believe in this one, hence that's where the bill came from. And I think it makes sense in a lot of ways. And I was the other night I came up with an analogy that I thought was pretty good for how this bill functions. And if you allow me to indulge myself briefly, the analogy is as such. Imagine a group of investors own a restaurant. And they each put in a bunch of money, and the restaurant is running. And at the end of the year, they want to get some revenue out of the restaurant. So they look at the numbers and they see how well the restaurant did. And they, based on profit, they each get a percentage of that profit as investors in the restaurant. And that's just fine. And that's just how it should be. If the restaurant had a good year, the investors get a little more money. If the restaurant lost money that year, maybe they won't get anything. Or if it did okay, they might get a little bit. But never is it suggested that the investors in the restaurant get a percentage of profit based on, say, the value of the building, because the real estate might be just going up and up and up every year, as real estate tends to do over time. So even though the building might be of certain value, their percentage of profit that they get for being stakeholders in the restaurant is based on the performance of the restaurant. And, you know, maybe someday they'll sell the building. But as the analogy goes, for Alaska, we won't sell the building. We'll keep the permanent fund, but we will take our dividend based on the performance of the oil, which is our main product that we sell right now, and other minerals that are included in this bill. So I support the bill, and I support you hearing it. Thank you.
We're all employees of the restaurant. Thank you, Representative Wohl. I'll note for the record, I'm not sure fully aligned with the methodology outlined in this bill, although I appreciate where the sponsor is going with it. And I think it's important this conversation happen, as I think it's important that there's a vehicle in the legislature to consider the formula as there is in the other body, even if I'm not necessarily oriented that this be the right formula. But I think that the question really needs to be asked and answered, because there's not mathematical sustainability at present. So I'll offer those comments. And Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. You said we had plenty of time, so I might as well pitch in as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was not here, obviously, on the committee when we first heard the bill and saw the statistics and had a deeper dive into it. I have had quite a bit of opportunity to speak to the sponsor about this bill in the evening hours in general. And in concept, I am highly intrigued by this. I believe running the state like a business, which I hear from many constituents sometimes, to find those efficiencies to make sure we're not bloating our state budget. At the same time, when a business is doing well, that's when it gives out the dividend at a higher rate based on its profitability. And I remember back to the
I want to say the 2008 legislative session when then-Governor Palin gave out the energy rebate on top of the dividend at that point was because the state was doing so well, yet that impact negatively trickled down to Alaskans, increasing their heating fuel, and that's where we saw very detrimental heating fuel costs and economic impacts by that in Fairbanks, my hometown, when the state and the state budget was very healthy. So I believe that this helps Alaskans as well. When the state's doing well, the impact at home can be negative, and it's an inverse relation that we don't see often. And so I believe this gets at that issue. And while I don't know exactly if it should be 33%, 35%, 40%, having that dialogue I think is going to be healthy for our state as a whole in the legislature as we move this bill through the committee. And I'm going to be tracking it closely because, like you said, Mr. Chairman, it's good to have this dialogue and understand where we're coming from. I think I hear from my constituents, this is their share in the resource wealth. I believe that a dividend is their share in the resource wealth, and I believe that this does accurately share in that resource wealth and helps people cover their cost of living more than tying the cost of or the height of the amount of a dividend to what's happening in Wall Street. Because at that same time, when the price of oil was going up in the late 2000s, the stock market was crashing, and we saw very small dividends at that time. So we would have seen inverse dividends at that time for Alaskans. So I appreciate it and look forward to following this closely.
All right. Representative Fields.
Thanks. I'm with the chairman on this. I think it's a worthy idea of being considered in the mix of other ideas. I don't know what the perfect formula for a PFD is, but appreciate the creativity. And I'm forwarding it in that spirit of let's have it in the conversation. So with that, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 132-31-LS0799-U as amended from this committee with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Seeing and hearing no objection, House Bill 132 moves from committee. That's the last item on today's agenda. Thank you, Martha. Thank you, Taylor. I think this is going to be the last state affairs hearing of the 2019 legislative regular session. So hold back your tears. And at 5:30 p.m., with one more day to go, we'll be adjourned and maybe see you in the interim.